This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A wrap-up of the implications of the Derek Chauvin trial includes the assessment it might be only a single case, but it's an important one that at least preserves the possibility of conversation.
If this conviction couldn't happen, I don't know that any could. I think the national dialogue is absolutely critical. Had it gone in the other direction, it would have been very clearly saying there was something about this jury.
Hear from criminal justice sciences professor Michael Gizzi about courts, cops, and regulation. An African American talks about the trauma created not just from the murder, but from watching the trial itself. And the police chief for the town of Normal tells how his department was already changing even before the verdict. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The city of Bloomington owes the town of Normal about $600,000. Normal city manager Pam Reese says the issue is over sewer fees for customers in Normal that use Bloomington water.
There has been a sewer billing mix-up, and staff from Bloomington and Normal are working together to get this resolved. And I can't really identify what the reason is why the interruption occurred.
Bloomington collects water and sewer fees and remits the amount for sewer service to the town, but apparently stopped doing that 9 years ago, and no one noticed. Reese says an outside audit will determine the precise amount Bloomington owes. The issue involves utility customers like the Bridgestone Firestone plant, Rivian, the Crossroads Center on the west side, and Carl Bromen Medical Center. A McLean County Board Committee heard several recommendations to reshape the county's top governing body at the first of three public hearings on redistricting. County Board Member Elizabeth Johnston proposed the county double the number of districts from 10 to 20 and give each district one representative instead of two.
In Shenoah, their closest board member is 30 miles away. That's almost the distance from my house to Lake Morton. We're a big county, and I would like to see us make sure that we have representation for each community in our county.
Two members of the public proposed the county reduce the number of county board districts. They say it will allow for more representation for rural areas. County health officials report two more COVID-related deaths. The McLean County Health Department says the latest were both female, one in the 60s and one in their 70s, neither associated with long-term care. That brings McLean County's COVID death toll to 216. The county's COVID hospitalizations reached a new record of 56. The county announced 91 new and confirmed coronavirus cases. Nearly 27% of McLean County residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
But the ones I have now feel like they're like bionic ears, because like if I'm in a restaurant and there's background noise, I can adjust those so that they just go a certain way.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Those around the nation glued to radios and TV screens for the last several weeks during the murder trial of Derek Chauvin are breathing a sigh of relief that it is over and that some of the lingering tensions over police and minorities in the nation have subsided for a little while. Now comes the effort to find or assign meaning to it. That is more than a single case. ISU Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Miltonette Craig kept track of the case for professional and personal reasons. She is African American. Craig says the case was extremely important.
It's just a little piece of justice for these types of very tragic events. So it's very significant. Hopefully it sets a legal precedent and adds to the argument of ending qualified immunity, even though that's civil, but it's still related to police misconduct.
In this case, there were special prosecutors. Should that be the template going forward to avoid having local prosecutors who already have a relationship with police continue?
Exactly. I agree with that because we need impartial third parties to be able to make these decisions as fair as possible.
Are there barriers to institutionalizing that approach?
Yes, there will be resistance at the local level, and because the decision makers are ultimately holding elected positions, if they see resistance from their constituents, then they might not move forward with calling in a special prosecution team. However, I do think if they are looking out for the best interests of their constituents, they would be amenable to that kind of approach.
Police nationwide have been fairly forthright about condemning Derek Chauvin in this case. Does the severity of the actions in this case make it easier for them to not look at this as a systemic issue?
That is a great question. I think the argument about bad apples will continue because it is a safer alternative to condemning the entire policing institution. And while, yes, there is justice, you're right that it may just exacerbate what they see as the validity of the argument that it's only some of us who are bad and not all of us. And while that is true, there is something very wrong with the system, with the institution, and it's deeply ingrained, you know, racially biased history.
What is the next step in the national dialogue on race and police?
I think the next step is dealing with recent cases that have just happened. So that of Dante Wright, that of Adam Toledo. My hope is that it will bring more officers to the part of the argument that says we have to do better as a team. We have to intervene when we see things like this happen. We have to report people, even if they are our colleagues, for doing wrong things. And so that's what I'm hoping comes from it.
That's a small cultural change, but there's also the matter that the courts have permitted and signed off on police use of pretextual stops and other investigative policing techniques that have turned out to have a tendency to create disproportionate enforcement. How can police be brought to consider those things?
I'm actually writing a chapter on the ways in which Wren with the pretextual stop and Terry that allows stop and frisk, how the court should review those things. So I think in police training, they should be explained, but also caution officers against abusing this, which may happen, but they need to do it a little bit more better, and then have supervision of these officers. I know that goes counter to funding, but there needs to be some kind of other person there that is reviewing their progress and how they operate on police stops and stuff. It shouldn't just be up to the drivers to hopefully get to their phones in time to record or call someone.
What was your reaction when the verdict came out?
I was extremely relieved. That was my first reaction because it is something that will, I believe, help with the healing process. Even though it's not like the cure-all, it definitely shows that a jury of, you know, your peers can see when you've done something wrong and that police aren't above the law. So I imagine that the verdict is going to be appealed at some point in the near future, but at least for today, again, the precedent is set, and the family at least can feel like some sort of their grievances in general have been addressed. at least to some satisfaction. It won't bring back their loved one, but I hope it just shows that the system can work in favor of those who are truly wronged.
Does the widespread condemnation by other police around the nation of Chauvin comfort or help the African-American community?
I think it's a decent decision, but we've heard about these promises to do better a long time ago. We heard about them after Rodney King. We heard about them after Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell and Eric Gardner. But things are still happening, and we need to know that, number one, we can prevent them from happening, but when they do, that we, you know, can get justice. We're still waiting for justice for Breonna Taylor. There hasn't even been an indictment in that case. And so we want to see at least the semblance of the system working for the aggrieved persons. Even though I was relieved, it's still traumatizing to think about the case. And I believe that people who support the George Floyd movement and Black Lives Matter will kind of feel similarly. Like, this was a very difficult thing to witness and to go through, but the fact that there is some sort of resolution adds to that relief.
Milton F. Craig is a professor of criminal justice sciences at Illinois State University. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
I didn't remember that when you pulled a straw out of a wrapper, it made noise. So those kind of things were just like a shock to me that they make a sound and I didn't know it.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
The fund drive may be over, but you can still make a contribution to Sound Ideas and the rest of the Central Illinois News WGLT brings you every day. You can do that at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Michael Gizzi is also a criminal justice sciences professor at Illinois State University. He often focuses on the courts and the interaction of police, prosecutors, and the law. Gizzi says, yes, the Derek Chauvin case is important, but in one sense, the importance is in what didn't happen, an exoneration, rather than positive ground gained from precedent.
If this conviction couldn't happen, I don't know that any could. I think the national dialogue is absolutely critical. Had it gone in the other direction, it would have been very clearly, in my mind, it would have been, you know, saying there was something about this jury that wasn't willing to convict the cop. I think it helped, because I think in some ways it might help cool down the tempers a little bit. It might, you know, it might alleviate some of the tension, but there is so much more work to do when it comes to police reform. We have a lot further to go in holding police accountable. You know, they're the only entity in government that is largely allowed to regulate themselves.
And where should the regulation come from? Who watches the guardians?
Who watches the watchers? You know, the people need to take control and take control through their legislatures. The challenge is, of course, no one wants to be painted as being, you know, weak on crime. And so historically, that's been very hard to do. And law enforcement has strong unions, and prosecutors are in the same camp. I would say in the last half a century, legislatures have not been willing. They haven't had the political will to do what they need to do, and which is to say, look, you know, law enforcement has a very important job, but they can't be so free from political accountability that they regulate themselves.
You and others in past interviews have made the point that the courts have largely allowed the rules to stand for use of force and have enabled police to use pretextual stops and other enforcement techniques that can lead to more violence in unfortunate circumstances. And that's not going to go away.
Yeah, no, and that's where, you know, even though the courts say that, you know, police have this freedom, this discretion, you know, when legislatures pass laws, courts tend to, you know, I still think it's, You know, we can't count on the Supreme Court to change anything. That's pretty clear. I know none of this is easy, but if the people won't act through their legislatures, then we'll never get anywhere. The real challenge is how do we accomplish the goals that we need? How do we get reform without, we can't eliminate policing. Policing is important. Police officers are important. They do good work. But we can't just simply allow it to be painted as, oh, it's just a few bad apples. When there's a bad apple, that causes the whole thing to rot.
Legislation is going to take a number of years, perhaps a number of decades, to filter through with court tests as well. So how can the police be brought themselves to change the way they think about use of force?
If we're serious about this, well, then police leadership, police chiefs, need to say, we're not going to train officers the way we have been training them. And we need to change that. But we need to realize that the culture runs deep and that to change the way policing works will never be a quick thing. We don't have the freedom, the ability to simply say, all right, we're going to just basically start over.
So how would you frame the importance of this case in America? Is it a huge turning point? Is it a signpost along the way? What's your sense of it?
I think it's a signpost. I'm not convinced that it will lead to a wholesale change. But I think every time you have an example like this where the officer who was clearly guilty of a crime in doing his job is held accountable, that signpost can make it easier for the next case. When you look at this case, basically, the prosecutors weren't that the individuals who prosecuted this case, they were not the normal, in Illinois, we would call the state's attorneys or the district attorneys. These were brought in and to deal with it because the prosecutorial police relationship is so tightly wound. It's very hard. But that could be one of the models that's very important is you leave it to the state attorney general to basically use special counsel, to try cases like this. We can't leave these cases in the hands of the normal process. I thought we were starting to make some progress in 2015. And then even though there was no Michael Brown, there was no in Ferguson. There was, the grand jury didn't indict. But then the 2016 election happened, and all of the advancements towards, reform in policing seemed to go out the window for 4 years.
Illinois State University Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Michael Gizzi, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Academics and advocates were not the only ones keenly watching the trial of Derek Chauvin. So were police. Rick Bleichner is police chief for the town of Normal. Bleichner says it was good to see justice done with the guilty verdict. He says he's also not surprised at other officers speaking out against Chauvin's behavior, something that is unusual in police shootings of civilians.
That's what I expect from law enforcement. That's what I've come to know from those that I've worked with, and so I'm certainly in that case. I think it speaks a lot for policing and where we're headed, and certainly there's a lot of work to do, but I think we've come a long way, and this is a good step, positive step to help us move forward.
In this case, there were special prosecutors, and it was not dealt with by local prosecutors. Is that a good idea going forward to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest because of the relationship between local prosecutors and local police?
I think there's certainly benefits to that. I know that when, there's been parts of police reform in Illinois over the last few years, with death investigations or in-custody deaths and those investigations not being able to be done by the agency who is where the police action occurred and the death occurred, I think is the right decision. And so, that's what we do in Illinois. And I think, there's some opportunities there for prosecutors. I think it takes away that potential for impropriety. And I think it adds to the
what's the next step for dialogue on police and race in the nation?
Well, I mean, I think we certainly, you know, we've made some strides even in the last year. There's been a lot of, a lot of modifications, a lot of changes to police actions or policies and such in the heels of George Floyd's death and this in Minneapolis. But I think we've got to sit down. We've got to continue to have these dialogues. We've got to, look for opportunities to get input from public when it comes to some of these critical policies and some of the types of programs that we're doing. We need to share better information about why we're doing them and why we do these things. And I think if we do that and continue to have some dialogue, it'll certainly move things forward. You know, we aren't Minneapolis, but certainly, we've learned a lot from what happened there and other places around the country. And so when you have a tragedy that happens, and that was certainly a tragedy, you've got to do what you can to learn from it. And if you don't learn from it, you're missing an opportunity.
What has changed in department practice and culture over the last few years because of cases like the one in Missouri and in Minneapolis and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a lot of focus more on, de-escalation techniques and tactics by police. So when there's, a situation where the officers can utilize, distance, they can utilize the surroundings to kind of put barriers between themselves and the individuals, if they can, utilize certain techniques for talking with them to try and calm things down, all those types of things together to help reduce the need to use force in the first place are key. And we've seen a lot of additional training in that over the last few years. On the heels of George Floyd, there were certainly some things, when it comes to duty to intervene by officers who may be seeing something that's an unlawful act, a duty for them to intervene, a duty for also for them to render aid if they see a situation where somebody needs aid. And, those are the types of things. I mean, we were fortunate in that we've had those in our policy for a long time. We did have an opportunity to look at those last summer on the heels of what occurred in Minneapolis, and we did make some additional modifications. And those are some things that I think, they seem to be common sense stuff, but you'd be surprised they weren't always in police departments' policies. And I think those are some things that need to be in there and are some positive things that have come in the last year.
What were the modifications?
Well, a few things for us. I mean, it really expanded the duty to intervene for us when we looked at it. We had a duty to intervene for our staff who may see something happen with one of our officers, regardless of rank. But we also work, we share just boundaries dividing us in Bloomington. We've got Illinois State University, the Sheriff's Department, State Police, and we work with many federal partners. And so we felt that it was important that if we see one of our own staff utilizing force in excess to intervene, but if we see any other police officer, regardless of what agency, they have a duty to intervene. And so that was one of the things where we felt it was important to go above and beyond just not just our agency, but if we see it happening somewhere else, to do what we can to intervene.
Most effective training is repetition. How will that point be repeated in the in your departmental culture going forward?
For several years, we have utilized scenario type training, where we do not only shoot, don't shoot type things, but we also work through different scenarios dealing with our less lethal type options. We also deal with situations that don't end up involving force at all, if the officer is able to use their de-escalation and their verbal skills. And so that is something that we're also going to enhance a bit. And just an example, last week within the last couple of weeks, the officer that shot the individual who seemed to, though, she was intended to use her taser. We've had several scenarios over the years where we transition back and forth between our tasers and our handguns, but we're also, this year, we're certainly building in even more of those types of scenarios so that the officers become even more familiar and they have more repetitions in doing that.
What is a duty to intervene scenario like?
Well, it's one of those where you may have a situation where you have an officer who is too, who gets in a situation and they're, we're human too. So we work through those. We have some role players where we will have those situations where the officer, hopefully the role players do a good enough job. The officers see the indicators that the officer is, his speech, their anxiety levels, their yelling and doing things like that. So hopefully they will pick up on those cues and intervene early on in the scenario and create some distance where they can have that officer removed and have another officer maybe step in before force gets applied. You know, if we see an officer who's overly anxious, who's aggravated, who's maybe verbally starting to escalate things, maybe another officer stepping in there and just taking a different approach and calming things down. That's our hope, to learn that through scenario training.
That's Rick Bleichner, the police chief for the town of Normal. All agree the road ahead in the dialogue over race and police in America will not be short or placid. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.